Thank you, Seth, for those kind words about this book and the introduction. I'd also like to say that I'm very grateful to be invited to the Sacramento Marxist School, and I hope that this institution prospers over the years to come. It's especially auspicious because tomorrow is May Day. In fact, most of the world today, right now, at this moment, is May Day. And there's something special about being able to have a discussion about the work of the labor movement on a day like today, which honors workers who were killed in Chicago in 1884. And it's an international holiday, and increasingly it's become one here in this country as well. In fact, unions today do not hold their Labor Day marches as much as they did in the past, but I know increasingly around the world, and in New York, in the United States, New York, and elsewhere, May Day is celebrated as the workers' holiday. And the United States, in that sense, is becoming much more like the rest of the world, and I think that's a very important development. I'd also like to thank PM Press and Ramzi Kanaan for setting this up. I know it's a big process and takes a lot of time and energy, and I strongly recommend you look at the list, which is a list of many different titles that I have read most of them, and I find them extremely interesting. And in fact, before I begin to discuss this single book, I'll say that there are three books that are linked together that happen to be published by PM Press. The first is a work by a historian that many of you know, Jeremy Brecker, or at least have read his work, called Strike, which documents the history of the American working class from the late 19th century to around the 1970s and 80s in a really wonderful way by presenting the history of labor from the workers' perspective, not management's perspective. And the book has been reissued by PM Press and I think even expanded, and I strongly recommend it. It also talks about the movement of workers from below as opposed to the ways in which business and labor leaders come together and negotiate deals. It's about the grassroots rank-and-file movements that have existed historically in this country, in which this country is very well known. And that book, which came out in the 1980s and now is reissued with a new introduction in this expanded version, is takes us to a specific era where around 30 or 40 years ago, organized labor was in excellent shape relative to today. The numbers we were just discussing with John Borsos a few moments ago, many of you may have read the numbers that came out from the National Bureau of Labor Statistics, which compiles the degree of labor organization in the United States, and it dropped even further still from something around 11.7% to 11.1%. And a lot of this has to do with the attack against organized labor, but even further, the attack against unions. And we're the working class who are seeking to mobilize themselves into various kinds of agencies and organizations. I don't have that copy with here, but you can find the book Strike. If you haven't read it, it's a classic. And I think it's I think it should be on everybody's labor reading list. The second book that I'd like to speak of, and actually it was just published, a month or two ago, is Solidarity Unionism by Staunton Lind. How many of you have heard of Staunton's work? Okay. This book, published originally in 1992, but expanded here by PM Press, deals with the organization of workers in the early 1990s. Well, as we all know, in the 1970s and 1980s, under neoliberalism that, as we all know, started before Reagan, but in earnest it was under the Reagan administration put organized labor under severe attack in this country. There was an effort in the 1990s to reverse this trend of declining numbers. And mind you, in the 1970s, at the end of the Carter administration, organized labor represented something like 25%, 20 to 25% of all workers, down from 30, 35% in 1955. Today, that number is less than half that, 11%. And what Staunton tries to do in this book, in my estimation, is deal with what constitutes a workers' organization. And that's actually a term that was used initially and continues to be used by the industrial workers of the world. The organization founded in 1905 and celebrating its 110th anniversary this July. In this book, we recognize the fact in the 1990s there was a transformation of labor. There was an effort by a number of people who found themselves to be activists in the labor leadership that, you know, maybe it's the problem of our leadership, that our leaders don't really get it. We need to get newer, we need to get newfangled types of advertising that connect better to younger workers, which, you know, younger workers then are now fairly, you know, my age and so forth. But getting to that point, I was thinking back then, you know, thinking of the ILGW song, Look for the Union Label. I mean, how many people can't sing that in your head? Look for the Union Label. I remember hearing it over and over in the 1970s. A union in New York City that really embodied the working class, because in New York, back in the 1970s, New York was primarily, or at least substantially, a working class city that manufactured goods. That tended to be, in most cases, was garments. And it represented women, a lot of women workers, but also men workers who got their start and so forth. The point I'm trying to make here is that what Staunton is arguing is that we do not need necessarily people who graduated from elite institutions, who have slick CVs or resumes that demonstrate that they have business school knowledge and so forth, that to contend with business. That really the basis for the organization of workers comes from the rank and file associations that are created at the base. That base is the rank and file, people who come together every single day and work at the same place. The term that he uses, and actually it was one that I came up with subsequently, before reading this book, I was thinking, well, it's already been written about. The term is parallel unionism. It's not the equivalent of dual unionism. It's the idea that even if there is a official union at a specific workplace, if that union does not really represent the workers, if it's disconnected in some way to the interests of the workers, if it's negotiating agreements that create two-tier contracts, one segment of the workforce making, say, $5 back then, and another segment making $20, which does not involve the workers in the day-to-day affairs of the union and the workplace and the community, that even if that's the case, there is still, on the grassroots level, amongst the rank-and-file workers, a union that exists, a workers' association, with or without a name. And so I strongly recommend to read this book. Staunton talks about the Youngstown workers' organizations that were formed independently during a very difficult period, the end of the steel industry in the United States for all intents and purposes, where steel mills were shuttered throughout the country. I remember it vividly and would say that, in fact, I lived in Youngstown for a period of time, and I would say that they're not necessarily going to ever come back. And some people might say that's a good thing because they pollute and create a lot of illnesses as a consequence of that, but they still pollute. No matter where they are on the planet, they still create the same kinds of pollution that kill children and the aged and the frail, and it's still a problem. We shouldn't be concerned, less concerned today about the lack of pollution in cities such as Pittsburgh, or I think Richmond. I noticed that there were a number of steel mills that were closed there, but there are much larger mills that are producing a lot of pollution elsewhere in the world, like Brazil, Korea, China, India, and so forth and so on. that's also killing people that we should have some concern with. In any event, this is a wonderful story about organizing that exists independent of unions with a name. Now, Staunton Lind harkens back to the legacy of the Industrial Workers of the World, founded in 1905 and continued to exist to this day. However, they declined in the late 19s of the last century, 19-teens, and however, they continued their activities to mobilize workers who did not have unions that represented themselves or represented them. And you know, anyone here can become a member of the IWW, Industrial Workers of the World, or Wobblies as they're referred to, a legacy that really paved the way for the mass insurgencies that took place in this country of the 1930s and the 1940s. Now, why do I say paved the way? If you read the mainstream sociological, political, and historical literature, I can give you names of the readings if you would like. It refers to a very important development that takes place amongst unions that you all are familiar with, and that is that there was a shift from craft unionism to industrial unionism, which reflected the shift that was taking place within industry itself, within capitalism itself, as we are going through a shift today into neoliberalism and financialization. Back then, industrialization in the United States was paramount. The IWW had a way of organizing workers, which was organize everyone on the shop floor. Don't segregate some workers into specific areas because they happen to be doing a certain chore that is not related. If the person is on the line and has a different skill, they don't have to be in a different union. They can all be in the same union. And by doing so, it does not draw down the wages. In other words, everybody's wages are lifted by lifting the bottom. And also, there was no discrimination on the basis of race, no discrimination on the basis of gender and national origin, although there were problems because of the nature of the kinds of organizing. They tended to be regionally focused. But that's another story that I won't get into at the moment. That notwithstanding, the 1930s became the heyday of American trade unionism, because both the Congress of Industrial Organizations, which you'll find in the book that I edited with a number of scholars and activists, including members of the IWW, I edited this work, and in my final chapter, I discuss the way in which those unions took on the form of the IWW, by organizing not just on the basis of craft, on the basis of one's, you know, a machine tool die maker versus another type of worker on the assembly line. You know, you would have steel plants where you'd have workers who did various skills and had different kinds of crafts that they took pride in. And, you know, industrial unionism got rid of that pride, something that's increasingly happened over the last 40 or 50 years. The CIO and the AFL both said that they were going to follow the same model because it was effective. It was the only way, really, to organize the new industrial working class back in the early 30s who happened to work in steel mills, automobile factories, on the docks. I mean, you name it, they worked everywhere, and especially in manufacturing. And I think that there's something in my work, that there's something to be said about differences between types of workers, even though the IWW organized shop floor wide. You know, there's a difference between somebody who is an accountant working in the office of a factory, who might be in the union too, which is that doubtful, and the worker who is on the assembly line. I think there's a difference between the two. And it reflects in the way people's ideologies are formed and their class consciousness is developed. In any event, we now have these three, we have the era of the industrial workers of the world, going into the era of the dominance of mainstream unionism. In other words, the model of the IWW became the model of the traditional existing unions. But there's a caveat to this, and that is that while the IWW advocated a revolutionary unionism, and by that I mean a unionism that disowned or rejected capitalism, that felt that there shall not be any basis within the system for contracts, because we can't trust the employers, which I think they are right about, because they'll break the contract at any time, that the state itself, any state, the United States, Canada, whichever state, is a pro-capitalist state. It's made up of the, it's a dictatorship of the bourgeoisie, or the violent dictatorship of the bourgeoisie back then. If you look at the 1919 Palmer raids and other efforts to use violence and imprison people who believed in system that was more equitable, what we have is unions that made compromises. Now, this is one of the points I make in this book about the United States, that American trade unions in general, and especially the 1930s and 40s when they were organizing steel workers, auto sectors, sector workers, electrical workers, you name it, for the most part, they believed in something called the collective bargaining agreement, which we all know about, and that's the idea that we need an agreement that's written down on paper that has boilerplate points that protect workers and so forth and so on, and that we need a procedure under which workers can strike. Because really what in 1935 was crafted by the federal government with the support of labor leaders was a new deal that reflected a peaceable relationship with workers. In other words, an end to labor militancy. In, I think, anybody's rational mind, although some people, it's stunning to me to think about, that when you have an agreement that says, workers, lay down your, don't lay down your tools, right? Because some workers call strikes laying down one's tools. If you're not allowed to strike, well, where's your power in some ways? I'm not saying you strike any time. Well, what many people refer to this, and I actually have as well, is essentially what a collective bargaining agreement is a long-term truce or ceasefire. But after a period of time, workers lose their ability to strike because the union contract historically over the last, between the 1930s and the 1980s and 90s till this day, has been eviscerated. The right to strike has declined dramatically, not just with respect to agreements that were made between unions and managers. There are many agreements where the union says, yeah, okay, we'll give up our right to strike if you give us an extra $1,000 in our contract. I mean, that's happened so many times. I can give you case after case. Even within unions that are considered progressive, that had the right to strike, they gave it up. There is a right to strike, but except in certain states and so forth. But in the private sector, it's one of the most important planks of collective bargaining. You strike if you feel that your conditions are not being met and so forth, or workers are being mistreated, wages are low, the safety situation is very bad. There are many reasons to go on strike. And this is the weapon of the workers. There are several others, of course, historically. And but this was also taken away by the state, by various Supreme Court decisions, as we see today that's happening in the Supreme Court, taking away various rights to collective bargaining, removing dues checkoff and so forth. Not to say, there are a lot of questions about that as well, but this reduces the power of contemporary unions. In 1939, the Supreme Court made a decision called the Fansteel decision, which I think really codified the nature of the state by saying workers cannot take over their factories. Now, I got to be honest with you, I've seen a lot of strikes. I don't know how you really, in most cases, are effective in your strike if you can't take over the factory. I mean, if you really want to be effective, if, you know, some of the strikes I see, if you actually occupy the factory, you stop production, you stop everything, you shut things down, that it kind of forces management to respond. Now, obviously, people have broken these strikes, gone to jail, I've broken these agreements, but all in all, what caused this was a strike wave in the late 30s, beginning with Flint in Michigan, the auto workers' strike, and continuing into the electrical industry under the UE, United Electrical Workers, with the important Emerson strike, which was also a industry-wide strike. It shut down the entire electrical industry. It shut down St. Louis, just like Flint shut down Michigan to a certain degree. The Emerson strike shut down St. Louis. And right after that, we have a decision by the Supreme Court that says, no, you can't take over your factory. Now, I'm of the opinion that these kinds of agreements have a effect that continuously erode labor's power over a period of time, labor versus capital. That if you have a situation where workers are not allowed to strike, are not allowed to withhold their labor, and also have management and union leaders that are increasingly making arrangements or collective bargaining agreements that are not directly related to the interests of the workers or do not involve workers themselves, that's a formula for losing your union or the end of that union. Now, you know, many of the unions in the United States have disappeared or merged into others. If we were living, 30 years ago and heard the names of some of the unions we have today, we may not recognize many of them, although some we still do. Certainly that's true in the UK, where the names of the unions have completely changed, and Germany as well. And along with it has been the power that workers have had versus capital on the job. A few other trends in the United States that need to be recognized is that since the 1990s, the new leadership of the union movement in the United States, going back to this in the 1990s, did not really transform the calculus. As noted earlier, union density declined from 25 to 20 to 18 to 15, now to 11, some people might even say less, and even 50% of the workers today are in public sector jobs. In other words, management controls the shop floor today, for the most part. There's absolute control over virtually everything, and even people who are in unions do not have much power. I mean, look at the stories of the UAW, in which the command lies squarely with the power that management has. Back in the 1980s, I remember, and 90s, I remember there were a number of publications that came out. Labor Notes was one of the publishers that came out with very sharp critiques of organized labor and its concessionary bargaining pattern that continued over time and created the mess that we have today, where you have two-tier contracts. You have workers who are employed at a place, it could even be a school or a former school like this, where they are employed by a different employer. For instance, at many schools, the cafeteria staff are private contractors, and their wages are not in line with norms and the wage norms. The discussion of this book, New Forms of Work Organization, is that there are many other kinds of examples of trade unionism today, both in the United States and throughout the world, that have moved away from these kinds of agreements. And just in a nutshell, my point would be, I've made this point before, that it's better in some cases not to have an agreement with management than to have any at all. That this 1935 decision and this agreement, the compromise, the class compromise was not a compromise whatsoever. It was a defeat because every single bit of power that workers had in this country, and it was reflected in other countries subsequently in Europe, etc., is taken away by the importance of being able to withhold one's labor, to also prevent production and other kinds of work stoppages and interruptions that take place on the job. I'm just going to take a drink of this. And some of the new areas where organized labor has tried to expand its power, has been through worker centers. Many of you have been familiar with this model, which the AFL-CIO is embracing, and a lot of unions are. I think that they're very important in some ways, but in some instances too, I was extremely interested in the idea of worker centers. I remember going to a meeting in 2002 with Staunton Lind, with worker centers in the New York City region, maybe 15 or 20 of them, talking about how they would organize on the job and so forth. It was a grassroots movement, but over a period of time, they became co-opted by nonprofit, or forgive me, by foundations. They became professionalized. There is a division between the staff and the workers. And while they advocate for workers, they don't really have direct worker representation for the most part. Not, you know, there are exceptions to the rule. I'm not painting a broad brush, but as a general rule, these worker centers have not had the degree of capacity to increase wages. Certainly they've done important things in legitimating undocumented workers, giving people various rights that they wouldn't have before. It's better to have something than nothing, but it's certainly not the model to what people referred to in the 1990s as union renewal or rebuilding the labor movement. I'm sure you heard that term or these terms before. There are a lot of monikers that were thrown around under the Sweeney years, John Sweeney as the AFL-CIO president, and subsequently that everybody had the best idea and was going to rebuild the labor movement through throwing money at organizing campaigns or through cutting deals with managers and management, agreeing to not organize one facility, let's say it's an SEIU hospital, in exchange for organization of another hospital across the country or across the world or in different contexts. That was the idea of organized labor in some ways going global, that they would cut deals with capital. And I don't want to pick on any union because I think most of them are essentially the same. They operate on the basic principles of bureaucracies that have already conceded power to capital, broadly speaking. This book starts out with an examination of cases, beginning with a very important movement in Italy that emerged after the major insurrection that took place in the 1970s. How many of you heard of the Hot Autumn in 1973? It was a time where workers actually believed that they could take over their factories, almost in the the Gramscian sense. Workers did take over factories, but they happened to be immigrant workers, or in this case, not really immigrants, migrant workers from the south of Italy who moved to the factories. Many of them were discriminated against. But there was a major upsurge. There was a lot of violence as well, unfortunately, but there was a major upsurge of working class activity in the major industries such as auto and electronics and so forth in Italy. And what happened is that the major unions of the country, the major union being CGIL, was not able to contain the working class militancy in Italy, and that many new types of organizations were founded. They were called COBAs, and there's a wonderful chapter that directly interviews the people who were involved in the formation of COBAs, which are committees of the base that were formed as organizations to represent workers who were not represented by the traditional at the CGIL, Confederation of Italian Workers, General Confederation. And they've proliferated throughout Italy, and they do represent workers, and yet at the same time they don't provide the same wages as workers used to have a generation ago, but they provide a representation for every kind of worker imaginable. It doesn't matter whether you're a service worker, it doesn't matter if you're a school teacher, healthcare provider, industrial worker, they're all represented by COBAs, and they happen to be increasing, and it seems to be a model that many unions in Italy are following. Forgive me, they are developing. Workers are developing their own unions. to the point where the states in various parts of Italy have to negotiate directly with these COBAs in order to have labor peace. And COBAs also are a form that seeks to create higher levels of worker ownership and control over industry, because in many instances, in the global north at least, we depend more on service labor than we had in the past. And Italy is an example of a European country where this is developing and continues to exist as a form.
As service-oriented or industrial?
Service-oriented? Both, across the board. Even though that they're primarily service-oriented. In fact, they even represent truckers, farm workers, and so forth in Italy. Because the state had no agency to negotiate with these new kinds of workers who were not represented by the CGIL, COBAs formed as a model of trade unionism, or workers' organization, in Italy that were developed by people who were part of the movement of the 1970s. And in addition, particularly workers in Italy who were southern workers, who continue to be mistreated to a degree in Italy, who had fewer privileges, who did not have the equivalent contracts. Anthony, forgive me, the Maniscalco, Anthony, Stephen Manicastri, I'm thinking of somebody else. Stephen Manicastri writes a very important chapter on this development that takes place, and in fact is writing a book on these forms right now as we speak, through doing research directly in Italy. But what they do is take the notion of the large industrial factory where you have one union, and they're following the structure of capital, which is increasingly decentralized in terms of its operations, to a very local level. And since unions, traditional unions, are not willing to represent them and not effectively representing them, these COBAs, which are admittedly forms that are that have leaders and so forth, which there's nothing wrong with having leaders, they have taken on a certain place within Italian society where they are in fact the representatives of those people who are the least well off in Italy. And they're continuing to this day. And in fact, it's, as I said earlier, it's becoming a model for a number of workers in Italy to expand. But what I would like to talk about primarily today is the major insurgencies that I've seen, and also the writers here document in this book, in the world today. To preface this discussion about the industrial workers of the world and autonomous organizing, we have today probably more strikes than any time throughout the history of capitalism. You know, that might sound counterintuitive when we talk about weak unions and so forth, when we, as I was just describing, the downfall of American trade unionism, that at the same time, on a global basis, more workers are withholding their labor, going on strike, taking over factories, kidnapping their bosses, and you know, doing other kinds of very militant kind of action in specific locations that are dramatically expanding workers' power, but in ways that we may not expect. And that's why I use the term new forms, because they are a new way of organizing within capitalism. And they also reflect a general fact that around the world we have more industrial workers than any time in the history of capitalism. As I was intimating earlier, today, the workers that were employed in the Youngstown Steel and Tube that Stott Lynn refers to in his book are now employed in Busan Steelworks in South Korea, or employed in an Indian steelmaker, and so forth and so on. They are now in the Global South in very large mills. Car production continues to exist today, but most of it, automobile production in the world by far, takes place outside of this country. You know, United States used to be the one of the major, if not the major, producer of manufacturing goods after the Second World War. You know, with the Marshall Plan and so forth, it sold a lot of goods to Europe and so forth. Many of us are familiar with this narrative about American industrialization and how it developed at the end of the Second World War, rebuilding Europe and exporting the capitalist model of unionism throughout the world as well. And anyway, so let me start with these three case studies that are found in this book. The first by Ouyang Liu, who writes about the Chinese workers' movement along with Rui Beiji. Another chapter that is by Arup Kumar Sen, who writes about the Indian labor movement. And the third by Sean Hayting, who writes about the South African labor movement. And I think they're very important because they reflect the reflect various types of cases where we see the resurgence of militant trade unionism and workers' unionism that reflect the industrial workers of the world model, a rejection of the forms of capitalism that have been imposed on most of these countries, where precarious labor is really in place, particularly in India, and also reflect the kind of organizing that many people would be very surprised about, starting with China, for instance. In China, we are all familiar with the All China Federation of Trade Unions. Well, maybe you're not, but it is a federation of unions that is the only federation in China. Well, we basically only have one, two here as well, but that's another point, which I won't get into. The perspective that this trade union dominates every single aspect of workers' lives, and that it's impossible to organize. Over the last 10 or 15 years, there has been a wave of strikes in China to the point that we have tens of thousands of strikes a year in manufacturers that produce everything that we drive, virtually everything that, you know, all the, our phones, computers, electronics goods, as well as you know, sneakers and footwear, clothing, you name it. The Chinese working class is very militant and they're striking their factories. One example, I'll give you two or three actually, of one example in 2010, which I think set this wave off, because at one point, you know, yeah, there was resistance to privatization in China. There was resistance to the establishment of redundancy agreements in the state-owned oil companies and facilities, because much of China was state-owned before the Deng Xiaoping era and subsequently. But there has been a dramatic growth of manufacturing in China that has expanded manufacturing for export, and much of it has been done through the investment of trillions of dollars of capital by Western banks and funders, Wall Street, the City of London, Hong Kong, you name it, have invested trillions of dollars through direct foreign investment in China, because they saw this as, oh wow, man, you know, we could produce what we produced in the South, a car. Let me just give you another example. We can produce a cell phone like this, let's say, or a recorder, for $1 instead of $10. We don't have to pay the workers as much. There's only one union, which is really no union, because the union is supporting management. So why not invest there? And a lot of capitalists, including some of our own well-known union-busting companies like Walmart, had engaged in investments in China that extended from the production of goods for Chinese retailers here in this country. A lot of the goods came from China, and they still do, although less so than in the past, to actually establishing stores, retail outlets in China. Walmart was one of the major buyers. In fact, I think it's probably because of China, it's a major reason why it was able to beat the other retailers to become the major chain store in the country by far, although that may be changing with the online situation. Anyway, what happens in China is this major industrialization. 2010, I was going to say, there was this Foxconn series of incidents that gained tremendous press attention. Anyone remember what they were?
Oh, yeah. Forced labor.
Suicides.
Right, people jumping out on nets that were put out and so on.
Yeah, the nets were put out to prevent those suicides. About 10 or 12 young ladies, young women, were committed suicide, which kind of reflects this kind of desperation that people had, that they were almost like forced labor, as you put forward, but in this case they went from the dormitory where they lived to the workplace, back to the dormitory, back to the workplace. After a number of years, they become redundant, and then they get, you know, basically thrown out of the system, had very little hope, and so forth. And many people said, well, this just reflects the kind of tyranny that people live in China, and certainly it did. However, in subsequent years, if you take a look at the last three, four years, there's been a major series of strikes at those same factories, because the Chinese government, first of all, couldn't take that publicity. It demonstrated that the All China Federation of Trade Unions was not doing its job in representing workers. And something else happened, and that's very important. The Chinese government said every worker in the industrial sector, because many of these workers are migrant workers from the rural areas of Southeast China and beyond, every worker is a member of the ACFTU. Now, this may strike you as counterintuitive, but that gives somebody some power if you want to take advantage of it, because there really isn't any rules that govern striking. Now, if you go back to the example I gave the United States, well, there really weren't any rules governing striking in the early 20th century America. People went on strike illegally. People went on strike in China illegally, although there's a degree to which, since they do have this sense that they're a worker state, that they have to support this working class. Things changed dramatically in China the last decade or two, to the point where Chinese workers, I'm not saying it's a panacea in any respect, because there's a long way to go with respect to these workers, but they're forming autonomous workers' organizations on the base. In fact, the Chinese government has even sanctioned something called grassroots unions, and there are thousands of them in China. And some of them, some of the better ones, have gone on strike, and some are going on regional strikes, connecting workers from one factory to the next that are producing the same goods, in part because of, believe it or not, certain forms of technology that they're able to use to tell people about wage gains at one place that they want to replicate elsewhere. There was also a Honda strike in 2010, where Honda parts factory workers went on strike to an extensive scale. They took over the factory. They said, we want our independent union here. We do not want the ACFTU to represent us. The government conceded after a period of time, because it became a huge embarrassment to the state. One thing about China, they do not like public displays of worker takeovers of factories. It's okay to take over your factory, but if you march down the street, that kind of chastens the government to say, oh, you know, we're in trouble, because the idea of being a worker state, a communist country, so to speak, it kind of is eroded by the fact that, why are all these workers not being treated well? So there has been a lot of repression from police against workers for street demonstrations. To my knowledge, not many people, people aren't getting killed there. People aren't going to jail for long periods of time. I'm not telling you that China is the panacea, but I'm telling you right now, and you can find out for yourself, even from the mainstream media, there is a major strike wave. And in some ways, I would argue that an independent kind of union that we have in the United States, based on jurisdictions, you know, between steel, auto, electronics, may not make sense, because that's a way to kind of differentiate wages. We'll say, well, you know, auto workers are working harder than the electronics workers, and therefore they deserve higher wages, or working harder than, and there are gender-based differences and so forth on these wages, and of course they exist in China as well. But by having one single union, I hate to say it, it kind of reminds you of the one big union. If you actually can control that one union, and you're against capital, fighting for rights under capitalism, let's say, you can have some power. A lot of people have been, this is not just my perspective. My perspective is widespread amongst academics who study the working class and labor in China. I can give you writer after writer is referring to this new movement, which is very different from the movement that began at the beginning of the 1990s, where they now have many more strikes, and they are now affecting global capitalists and financiers. Yes?
Are these organizations, independent workers' organizations, considered independent with...
No.
Is that a, well, how does that work?
Well, I think it works in a very irregular fashion. First of all, there is something, as I referred to before, called grassroots unions that are have been developed on the base level. It's like in Italy, they represent workers in the factories and in the communities. And they've been sanctioned by the ACFTU as legitimate unions. But once you have a strike, the main goal of the government and the main goal of the trade union is to get stop the strike. They're very, because strikes, there's no procedures to govern strikes. You go on strike here, you know, there's a cooling off period, there's a whole set of procedures in which we understand under the National Labor Relations Act and so forth, that's ensconced, and many other laws that have been enacted subsequently. In China, there aren't really any laws. So workers go on strike haphazardly, periodically, and for periods of time, and there isn't any organization that's formed because you're not allowed to form one. There's the ACFTU,
so
and that's
it. So does the Chinese government pretend that they're actually part of it?
Chinese government does
you
not...
You think that they would really repress those strikes...
actually, but what's happening...
It couldn't be this kind of dance that's going on there.
Elaborate, because I think it's very interesting what you're saying.
I'm wondering if... you began your discussion by talking about the IWW.
Right.
And the IWW organization that would take in any group of workers that would want to join, wherever they
within the factory.
Yeah, and you're speaking that the situation in China has become analogous to that type of organization.
In some ways.
All right. But the Chinese government says there's only one union.
Right.
So how does this work out?
I know a lot of people are... I agree. I think that's a very good point. Okay. Let me adjust my point initially. Mm-hmm. It's analogous, but not in a lot of ways analogous. I mean, we're working in a different environment and so forth. China has a very different history than the United States. It was an imperial... occupied by the Japanese, the British, and many other countries, and its history is one that is primarily related to anti-imperialism and primarily a peasant society. But just to the point, that the specific issue here, I'm not saying that these workers have a union of their own. What I'm saying is that they have power on the shop floor in the same way that Staunton talks about this parallel unionism. The fact that they actually have an organization that may not have a name. It doesn't have a name of, in this case, it would be the Yuewen Footwear Workers Union. That would be a kind of an example of it. They're not going to allow a union that is independent in China.
So
not yet. And I think that's not, I mean, in some ways, that's an interesting point.
Yeah, so the question goes back to the why aren't they being repressed? Are the Chinese weak to repress them, or what?
Well, there's a lot of perspectives on this. First of all, they are being repressed. I mean, there's no question about that. I went to a number of meetings where, you know, workers are complaining about this or that, but, you know, they talk about this place not having any democracy at all, but I hear, you know, I go to meetings where workers are complaining about the employer openly in meetings that are being held in various cities in this region that I'm talking about, the Pearl River Delta, which produces more manufacturing goods than any other region in the world. It's the biggest port, from Hong Kong all the way up to Guangdong. It's called the Pearl River. The point here is that the repression is... This is actually, I think, your question and point, is that the state will not allow any political competitor to the Communist Party of China. It will not allow any competitor to the ACFTU, but the ACFTU is getting weaker, because it cannot control these strikes. And the Chinese government is embarrassed. The new leader has enacted a number of new forms of restrictions on questions of corruption by major capitalists in the country. In addition to that, the Chinese government is pushing the union to settle these strikes over and over again, because it not only embarrasses them, but it cuts production. In the strike of last year, which I think is one of the most, the biggest private sector strike in the history of China, some 40,000 workers at the shoe manufacturer that makes Adidas, Nike, Reebok, it's a contractor that's owned by the Taiwanese government, or the Taiwanese, and also has funding from the Chinese government as well, called Yuewen. Produces millions of sneakers every year. You know, most Adidas come out of that factory or out of that company. And Taiwan invested a lot of its capital into this region. And what's happened is that when you have a strike that affects the entire city of Dongguan, which is equidistant between Guangdong and Hong Kong, in this small area where there's some 75 million people, the state of Guangdong, it is a situation that is combustible. And the Chinese government does not want to see this happen. It may actually happen eventually, but the Chinese government wants to control it as much as it can. Just as the United States government tries to, you know, I don't think they're facing these kinds of strikes. Obviously they're not, or they may have in the 30s, but every country has a different institutional regime, and in this case, the Chinese government is pushing a very ineffective union called the ACFTU. I mean, people think of it as this dominant union. It's not recognized by the International Trade Union Congress because they're a communist-dominated union, and so forth and so on. Meanwhile, the FNPR, which is the former communist union in Russia, which was actually going on strikes in the 1990s, this is actually a very instructive lesson. For non-payment of wages, some of the same kinds of issues, they are now co-opted into the government. And in Russia, there's really not much labor mobilization at all. It's kind of ceased to take place. There's not much non-payment of wages either anymore as well. I mean, you know, the government wanted to quell those strikes. I'm sure the Chinese government would like to do the same thing, but it's very difficult, especially because of a number of demographic factors. The one-child policy has certainly had an effect in reducing the level of strike, reducing the reserve army of labor, the size of it, it's contracted, and that a lot of industry has moved to places like the Philippines and Indonesia and beyond to lower, as well as Cambodia and other places, Vietnam, as I said, to take advantage of lower wage labor where there's more abundant labor supplies. There was also a major strike in Cambodia a few years ago, which actually about 18 months ago in the garment sector. All in all, I'm trying to say, and also in Vietnam, there are strikes that are taking place because it's basically producing for the Western markets there. The point I'm making then should probably be modified in this term, because it really reflects the kind of unionism that's grassroots-based, that's based on rank-and-file solidarity, that comes and goes, although it's there. I mean, I can get one example that I can give, which I think is the most remarkable, is this Dongguan strike of athletic footwear producer. 40,000 workers went on strike. It affected the entire region of this part of China. It made headlines everywhere but the United States. It had major ramifications for the state as a whole. They struck over a very interesting group of issues, pensions. They struck over, it unified older workers or senior workers with younger workers, because the senior workers said, you know, we want you to support our strike over pensions. It's a long story about the pension issue. And we'll support your issues related to housing in the dormitories, work hours, time off, food in the commissary, and you name it. And the workers came together to form a bloc, and no one went to work for, well near 2 weeks. It's a 2 week. I mean, that's a very important strike that, as I said earlier, was only put down. That there's a lot of put down by the government after they conceded to these issues over pensions primarily, and also improved housing, and promised to do so. But those workers are still there in the majority, and they're still willing to go on strike. Now, one thing the government did is that the leaders of the strike were fired. ACFTU did fire the leaders of that strike. they're referred to as gang leaders. The foreman actually led, I mean, this is kind of really a wonderful story. The foreman led the strike. They were considered the gang leaders, and they were punished for it by losing their jobs. No one went to jail or anything like that. There were street demonstrations and so forth. The point I'm making here is that there is worker militancy in China. We don't know which direction it will go. It's a very it's a wild card, although one thing is clear, that it's not going to stop. And it's increasing dramatically at this point. And some of the answers to resolving if the government wants to resolve the strike wave is not adopting even more free market policies. I mean, they have to ensure that workers have safety on the job, workers receive pensions. And I make the point, and I think I'm right about it, because I spoke to a number of occupational safety people there, that I think Chinese workers have greater health care rights than we do here on the job. You know, they can see, if they're not satisfied with the decision of a hospital, they can have a second or third opinion. I don't think we have that right here, for the most part, unless you have a Cadillac plan.
You don't even get a first opinion.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and we're talking about people who are working making cell phone batteries, where apparently, I forget the name of the element at the moment, in the battery produces kidney disease.
And you know, one of the rare earths, though, isn't it?
It's every battery, it's actually dangerous. Don't open up your cell phone battery. If you open it, you can be exposed to that. I forget the name. Forgive me for the moment. Workers are concerned with that, and they'll have as many tests as they want. We can talk about China only today, if you'd like. Mm-hmm. I think it represents a crucial example of worker self-activity, and there's a lot of ramifications for the ways in which struggle is taking place. You know, the neoliberal NGO, China Labor Bulletin, which is supported by a lot of Western governments and unions, has now changed its position on the ACF, All China, now saying, yeah, you know, maybe they are really the representative of the workers. The fact is that they are very weak. And they're, you know, they really don't have structures. If you think about even from a practical sense, when you go from a workforce of, say, you know, 50 to 100,000, let's say 100 million, to one of 400 million, to 500 million, or let's be conservative, 300 million, the union really has to get its act up if they're going to be represented. A major development under capitalism, I think a very important point that makes me excited is that, you know, really demonstrates where workers are fighting and fighting hard for issues related to their rights and doing so collectively. You know, where older or younger workers from rural areas and so forth are engaging in solidarity, where migrant workers in China have gained the right to sit, to live in the cities where they're working. Before that was not the case, before 2008, a new law was enacted. The government is constantly conceding. Now, you know, this is not, you know, we're not strategically and tactically analyzing what to do next and where it will go, but some people are. I mean, some people are saying this is increasingly taking the form of a regional force rather than a factory-to-factory force. So, for instance, in companies that make the iPhone, the the Apple iPhone, many of the component parts, you know, the screen, the batteries, the keyboards, and so forth, are made by different companies that are contractors. Apple will not even admit to some of the contractors it has that has very poor, that have very poor working conditions. And there have been major strike waves in the same region for workers who are seeking equivalent forms of justice. And without a union, that's, I think, the main point. And the point that Staunton makes in his book is that we're now seeing a parallel form of unionism that is growing dramatically in the global south. The other example, I don't know how many minutes, I don't think, do I have a few more minutes? I could skip India, but I think it's a very interesting case study, because I'd like to move on to South Africa, where we have found actually the development of a new workers' movement out of the anti-apartheid movement, which created a tripartite agreement between the African National Congress, COSATU, the Federation of Trade Unions in South Africa, and the South African Communist Party, over the course of the last, well, ever since 1994, there was an agreement regulating the right to strike, saying you can't strike, and basically extending the laws of the apartheid era to the post-apartheid era. And that's basically what a lot of people wanted to do. I mean, with all the good intentions of Mandela, he did accept neoliberal capitalism as the model. Maybe he was forced to do so. It's not a critique of him personally, but this tripartite government is a model that we call within the field of labor relations, many are aware of it, it's called corporatism, where the state and labor are connected. You know, some people would say, well, this is great. In some ways, that was what China is. You know, the state and labor is connected. But what if that labor movement or labor union doesn't support the workers who are at the grassroots level? At the very same time, from about January 15th to about June 10th or 15th, there was a 5 to 6 month strike last year in the platinum industry, which is discussed in this book, Solidarity Union. We're going to have broader discussions with Staunton at the Watcha meeting about this whole periodization. Platinum is a major industry, mining industry in South Africa. It's not really gold anymore. It's platinum, although it's now extending into the gold industry, these fights, these struggles. The workers have formed assemblies. They actually had assemblies in various different locations. I mean, this is the epitome of worker control, where workers basically took over their mines over a period between 2009 and today, and they really exercise control in the region. Go there, you'll see. I mean, they're basically leaders of various groups and associations who make decisions. These people have incredible charisma, but they also everybody seems to have it there. They also were striking over issues of their very existence. A lot of it stems from the Marikana massacre of August 16th, 2012, where there were 34 workers who were killed by the South African State Police with the complicity of the National Union of Mine Workers, which is the major union in South Africa, mining sector. And what happened over a period of 5 years, but especially over the last year or two, is that the workers no longer are really members of the National Union of Mine Workers. Or even if they are, they don't really follow them. They don't pay, you know, they don't have any relationship whatsoever to them. They are, in fact, pushing the formation of a new union, which is kind of, many of us, you may say, well, what kind of union is this? When I tell you what kind of union it is, it's led by a person by the name of Joseph Muthunjwa, who's not very well known in this country. You know, people know Irvin Jim, but not Joseph Muthunjwa. He's a Salvation Army trumpet player. I mean, you know, this guy's the leader of our strike, okay. And he also helped a factory takeover in the coal mining sector in 2005, before the strike wave began in the mining sector. Subsequently, they closed down that plant. But he gained a reputation in South Africa of being a representative of the interests of the workers of the mining sector, which were not represented, where wages were about the equivalent of $250 to $300 a month, which is low for the third world. Just to make a long story short, because time is running out, those wages increased to about $800 to $900 a month in a period of 2 or 3 years. I make the analogy, can you imagine if you tripled your wage? It's like almost winning the lottery, if you're able, I mean, depending on where you're working. If you triple your wage from $50,000 to $150,000, that's nice. It's a nice increase in one's wage, or seven, you know, whatever the case may be. There they did that, and actually they're still fighting. But what happened here is that in 2012 there were these worker assemblies that were formed. One of the most famous is in Marikana, the city which is in the Merensky Mine Belt, which is to the northwest of Northwest Province, northwest of Johannesburg and Pretoria, the center of the country. Where the most precious resources in the world are actually held. $14 trillion of platinum is in the earth in that country. Platinum, by the way, produces catalytic converters, and it's necessary for every automobile. So in some ways, a part of the production chain of automobiles, essential parts of it, and 80% of all platinum is in South Africa, in this little belt. Very beautiful area, starkly beautiful, but what happened here is that you had these assemblies. People refused to go off the mountain in Marikana, which is right near Rustenburg, not far. I'm not going to give you the geography, but it's very interesting. Major multinational corporations control it. The South African government urged the workers to leave the mountain, or major consequences would take place. It sounds like the American government today. They were, in some respects, they refused to leave the mountain. They refused to recognize the official union. They didn't necessarily support this union led by this trumpet player, the Association Mine Workers and Construction Union. That's their name. You'd call it a rump union. A lot of people don't like to think of it because they don't really have a politics. In some ways, I don't care. Yeah, I mean, I don't care how left your politics is. This guy's actually a rank-and-file leader who his own leadership depends on whether or not he follows the workers' lead. Because this union, which its numbers changed from about 1,000 members, let's say 5,000 at most, to well over 100,000 members in a period of a year or two in South Africa, that's a major achievement, maybe even close to 200,000, if I understand. And it also led to a series of rolling strikes in South Africa. One of the more politicized unions in South Africa is called NUMSA, the National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa. And it, these wage gains that were taking place in the mining belt were also demanded by auto workers and mechanics and so forth, that were not getting these kinds of wages that were so crucial to people's lives. It was right after the strike was settled in June, the very next month, July 1, boom, NUMSA goes on strike. 100,000 workers are on strike for 1 month. They win major gains. For whom? For the lowest wage workers. Now that is really remarkable, because the same kind of pattern took place in the mining industry, where the most oppressed workers, the rock drillers, were the ones that got wage gains because the company refused to give equal wage gains. This is the same kind of dynamic that I wanted to talk about briefly about with respect to India, where workers who were contracted out working in the same plant, Suzuki plant, owned by Suzuki Corporation Company, Motor Company, at a plant south of New Delhi, they went on strike for equality in wages between full-times and contracted workers. Contract workers were making, they represented about 75% of the workforce, 75% of all 3,000 workers at this factory that produced cars faster than any other plant, any other factory in the world, were making a fraction of the $500 average wage that the other workers were making, if they were lucky. On both sides. To make $500, you had to work overtime and all these procedures. But to think about solidarity, that is an example of solidarity, unionism, that Staunton talks about, and I think these essays of this book, the chapters deal with Maruti Suzuki, the lowest waged workers were fighting alongside those workers that were paid three or four times as much, doing the same kind of work. And they were fighting for regular jobs and equality of pay. This changes formulas around the world, but it also reflects a kind of unionism that's in both the interest of the workers who had been regularized as full-timers and those people who were treated as part-time workers. And I would argue that it's not something that's happening in three countries. It's happening in South America, in places like Colombia. Avi Chomsky writes a very important essay about the Citra Carbon coal miners in Colombia. There is an essay about Argentine workers in the transport sector fighting for an independent union. There are essays around the world, even in Russia, believe it or not. And there are also two very important essays, one about the Jimmy John's workers here in this country by Eric Foreman, where he discusses the way in which young youth workers in this country are fighting for dignity at sandwich shops, and actually led the way for the kind of organizing that SEIU and the Fight for 15 campaign has generated. It actually started out of an IWW union campaign called the Jimmy John's Sandwich Shop Workers Union. It was called Jimmy John's Workers Union. And these workers were actually informed by the Starbucks Workers Union, who don't have representation. Now we have this big publicity campaign and a lot of energy into the workers' movement in this country that is low-wage, youthful, low-wage, precarious in a certain way. where people are arguing about their wages, but the foundation of it actually comes from an IWW practice. I think Eric Foreman's story is really interesting. In the UK, there's a very good story, although things have changed in the IWW unions there, where there is an effort to organize cleaners at the University of London. The ways in which communities have come together, these cleaners happen to be from South America, male workers from South America, the ways in which they come together and seek to create justice, I think it's a great example of solidarity across borders, as are many cases in the United States. Anyway, there's a lot more to talk about with respect to this book. I think each of the chapters that the authors had written are a lecture, if you're interested, upon themselves. But anyway, thank you very much for having me and listening to me, and Happy May Day.